Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast from the Hoover Institution. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here, of course, with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And, Victor, it's been a couple of weeks since we talked last, and here we are with summer starting to creep into fall, and yet the sort of long-forecasted demise of Donald Trump has yet to take place. You wrote about it for National Review this week. And let's start here. You make an interesting point in there, which is that Donald Trump basically hails from the same East Coast establishment that he likes to tweak. He's got a kind of arrogance that is at least as pronounced as President Obama's. These are things that you'd expect to turn off Republican voters, and yet they almost seem to be part of the appeal. Explain why you think that is.
Well, you know, he's an elite, but his message is, I know the elite so well, and I'm so intimate with them, that I can guarantee you they're worse than you think, and I'm not one of them. And then the other message, of course, is they handle money, they exchange money, they talk, they do everything but build things. And this is what America needs now, as a builder. So in the way that Ross Perot did it, another billionaire, he's able to separate himself from his own class and appeal directly to the working class. And he always talks about, I'm making jobs, I'm hiring Hispanics. That tends to work pretty well. The other thing that's appeal is that the Democratic field is in chaos. And I think there's a third of the Republican Party feels, you know what, it's summer, we can indulge ourselves with Trump. We don't want this guy to get off TV. We like what he does to the elite media. We like his bombast, and as long as they don't have Hillary 30 points ahead of everybody in theoretical races with our candidates, we can continue to have this luxury. If Hillary had no problems at all and had the nomination sewn up and she was running, you know, 30 points ahead of Rubio or Bush or everybody, people would be out to get Trump even more than they are now. So he's an indulgence of the summer that's tolerable, I think they think. And then finally, of course, the main reason why he's continuing is people do not like the New York-Washington nexus, that elite in journalism, academic politics. And that includes Republicans, because they don't want to be told that they don't have the presidency and this is a tripartite government. They want some symbolic act. They're saying, you know what, why didn't you stop Obama on the treaty by insisting that it was a treaty and it required two-thirds approval? Or why didn't, if you can't shut down the government because it's suicidal on amnesty and things like that, why didn't you at least make an emotional appeal? Why didn't you at least make the case? And they feel that Boehner and McConnell are status quo politicians and they're careerists, and there's something to that. So I don't think Trump is going to make it, but I don't, unlike a lot of my colleagues, I don't think he's going to self-implode or self-destruct until November, December. And then I think people are going to get a little bit tired of every journalist who can't get a good answer from him is third rate or amateurs or a hack or I'm not up to their game. And every person is tremendous, exceptional. I'm going to do this. It's going to make your head spin. I think all of that jargon will get tiring after a while.
You say,
but not yet.
You say in your piece that there is something Ajaxian in the Trump call to make America great again. We hear from a lot of listeners who appreciate when you make connections with the classical world and modern events. Unpack that Ajax analogy there.
Well, Ajax was a Homeric hero, but he was best amplified by Sophocles in a play of that name, in which his motto was live nobly or nobly die. In other words, he's sort of the archetypal Western that we know from our own popular culture, whether it's Shane or the Searchers or High Noon, a man that won't compromise, won't change his principles, even though the world has passed him by. And so I think there's a lot of supporters of Trump who say, you know what, I don't really care if we lose the Latino vote because I'm sick and tired of not enforcing a federal statute in a way that I have to pay my IRS tax or I have to follow a traffic ordinance. Or they're saying, you know what, Black Lives Matter is really a racist organization, and I'm going to say that. Or they're going to say, you know what, I'm not a racist for attacking Obama for running up the debt for $20 trillion it will be. So I think what they're saying is, I don't really care about the dynamics of the election or this hyphenated group or that hyphenated group, and I'm not going to listen anymore where you call me white privilege. If I lose the election, fine, but I'm not going to cater and kowtow to you. And that's been a very popular subtext of Trump's appeal.
Well, and to that point, you mentioned in this piece, we've talked about this on the show before, what we might call, for lack of a better term, political bean counting. In other words, especially for Republicans, you can't say this because it'll alienate the Hispanic vote. You can't say that because you'll alienate women, you know, et cetera, pick your identity group. But you drop a provocative suggestion in here that that street runs both ways and that Democrats should maybe be more concerned about what's going to happen to them with white voters. What do you see developing there?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's the point I was trying to make. I mean, we can't say white lives matter. What a ridiculous situation we've come to. And this is, I mean, people are tired. It was black power, then it was black pride, and it's a black thing you don't understand. And then it's, you know, black lives matter. And people are in a multiracial society in the 21st century. And so they're saying now, it's 50 years after the civil rights movement. We can't do that anymore. La Raza shouldn't exist anymore. Either should black. It's people. And the result is that everybody says, oh, the Republicans are going to lose if they don't get this percentage of the black vote or this percentage of Latino. Maybe, but it works both ways. The Democrats are getting very close. I think Obama got 43% of the white vote, and the Republicans are getting very close at 58-60, where in the next election of that 70% of the electorate, should the Republican nominee get 63%, it won't matter if they don't get 70, they don't get 30% of the Latino vote. In other words, just as we're creating monolithic black and Hispanic votes, the Democrats, by their rhetoric to achieve that goal, have also achieved what's emerging as almost a white monolithic vote. And unfortunately for the Democrats, it's still, it's not 85% under Reagan, but it's 70% of the electorate, maybe 72%. And if they start voting at 65% of that because of what the Democrat Party is doing, I don't think they're going to win. And you've already seen it in the midterm elections of 2010 and 2014 when the turnout is not as well, but it could happen in a general election. I think that's what the Democrats are worried about, and we know what they're going to do after they play identity politics and go hard left in the primaries. They're going to be back having Boilermakers, bowling, and appealing to the cleaners again. But I don't think it's going to work. I really don't. I think people are angry at them. That's what Trump represents. When he said to Jorge Ramos, go back to Univision, that was sort of, Jorge Ramos was a stereotypical whiny, cranky, boisterous person who's demanding something that it's against any decent protocol. You wait your turn, you're polite, you don't give lectures. And who cares if he's a Hispanic? And then there was a hypocrisy. Here's a guy who was screaming and yelling, whose daughter works for Hillary Clinton, and whose company that he's owned by is the big Clinton supporter, and left Mexico to become a U.S. citizen, and yet he's more critical of the United States than he is of Mexico. And Trump represents that anger. And the other Republican candidates don't understand that when they try to say, calm down, Donald, you're doing something that's nastier, divisive, then they play into that, to what he wants. So people, especially Jeb Bush, have got to be sober and judicious, but they've got to channel that anger, and they're not doing it. When you say an act of love is illegal aliens, a lot of people say, no, you know, my son got hit by one and he ran away, or my kid's in a school where they're not allowed to speak Spanish, or my daughter's at UC Irvine and illegal aliens have in-state tuition and she's from Montana, has to pay the fool. So I don't want to hear that lecture anymore from elites like Jeb Bush. This movement's coming from the lower and lower middle class.
Well, and sort of to that point, I want to give you an opportunity to share some of your field data, as it were, because you describe in your National Review piece your interactions with three different people, none of whom really should have been friendly to Trump, all of which seemed to respond to something different about him, but all of the reactions were sort of surprising. Describe those interactions.
Yeah, I did. I see mostly Hispanic people in my hometown. It's about 90% Hispanic, and I talked to one or two of them most recently on Trump, and I thought I would get a shotgun blast of opposition. They didn't. They said, you know, they like him. He's decisive. He's a jefe. He's a man, a big man, and they like that. They like the idea. They don't have a lot of respect, even for people politically aligned to them, the nasal-twanged white elite. They kind of like that idea. And then I talked to a PhD woman I know, and I was trying to explain Trump, and she said, touche Trump. I turn him on because he just leaves the whole bar room full of corpses, and every once in a while we need to clean house. And then another person that I know who has a PhD said, you know what, I'm going to ride this wave until the wave is going to take me under, then I'm going to jump off if I have an alternative. But I like what he's doing to Jorge Ramos. I like what he's doing even to Megyn Kelly. I like what he's doing to the journalistic class. And I don't think the journalistic class or the politicians in Washington have any idea of the hatred that they've incurred. And Trump is capitalizing on that. And so it's anti-empirical. They don't want to hear that he was tripped up by you, Hewitt. They do not want to hear that he probably said something boorish about Megyn Kelly. They're just tired of being lectured about this ism and that ology. And he's been brilliant in exporting those fears. I mean, I don't want to be derogative, too derogatory, but he reminds me of an early Mussolini who had the same ability to get anger in the Italians, how they did not get what they should have got out of the Versailles Treaty. They won, they lost 1 million men, and all of these grandees in France and did that to us. And boy, he did it in a sophisticated way, and he came to power. And Trump is just brilliant doing that. And these people don't have a clue why he's succeeding. I keep thinking he's going to implode because he's a buffoon, but you can be a buffoon and not quite implode for a while.
So final question then. You said that you anticipate it maybe petering out by the end of the year. How do you think that this eventually plays out? That is to say, does all of the factors that are sort of animating the Trump boomlet, do they disappear with him? Or do you think that those things sort of penetrate through into the Republican Party even after maybe his candidacy falls off?
That's a $64,000 question. Is that 30% or 25% that likes Trump? Can they be transferred through osmosis to one of the other candidates that they feel is not antithetical to Trump's anger and message? And in some cases, they can't. I don't think that obviously Lindsey Graham or Chris Christie or even Jeb Bush, if they're nominated, they're going to lose a portion of that. There's no way they can reinvent themselves to that degree. But if there was a Scott Walker, maybe Marco Rubio or Carly Fiorina, I think they have the ability. One of the weird things about Trump is he's made former outliers, mavericks that weren't part of the establishment, even like Christie or Rubio that were really, and Walker that were Tea Party guys, he's making them look staid and complacent and part of the establishment. People don't realize that just 2 years ago, they were the Donald Trump. And now we're treating them as if they're Mitch McConnell. You know, it's not fair, but it's true.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Join us next week for the next installment of the Classicist podcast. And in the meantime, stop by hoover.org. where you can read all of Professor Hansen's commentary. We'll see you back here soon. For Victor Davis Hansen and the Hoover Institution, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.